This is CliffCentral.com.
It is time for the Burning Platform, which is most people's favorite way to start their Thursday, and today will be no different. I tell you this every week, and you know, it's true. People go to the coffee machine and they go, "Oh, have you heard about this in the news?" And sometimes people haven't. So what they like to do is to sometimes check in with us on the Burning Platform. And right in line with the Burning Platform, I'd like to introduce our guests for this morning. We have Kayas Tole, who lectures financial accounting at Wits University, serves as the Tutuga Project Coordinator. He trained with First Rand Group and worked at, is that Saika? Because I think it's been spelled wrong.
That's such an old profile. I left Wits in 2016, brother.
So, well, give us an update.
I piss off politicians where I live in these days.
But that's nothing new. No, everybody in this room does that, doesn't
it? No, people pay me to do it. Yeah, that's exactly
right.
So
do all the people in this room. So what makes you
obviously
special?
We're in a different zone, because usually I'm the only person in the room who gets paid to piss off politicians. So in this case, clearly there's more of us.
Well, welcome. Welcome to our little
welcome
tribe.
Welcome to this club.
I'm finally home then. Yeah, this is where I belong.
As a friend of mine is fond of saying, if you're the smartest person in the room, get another room.
Yeah,
and you didn't get the other room.
Here we are.
So, yeah. All right, so Kaya, you're very welcome, and I met you the other day, well, I've met you before that as well, but I met you the other day when we hosted a debate, which we're going to be introducing soon, a brand new series on cliffcentral.com where we allow young people to have communications of all kinds to argue with each other and debate things in a sensible way, showing off that we don't have just kids at Forest Hill School are stabbing each other. We actually have very smart people coming out of our education system.
The EFF,
or the kids in Parliament. Yeah.
Or the EFF creating like altercations during training.
But we'll tell you more about that when we get to it. Anyway, Kaya's here, Canton is here, and Pumi is here, and we're going to talk about some of the issues in the news.
Has run off.
Are we still going to get Marianne Merton in? Okay, she's going to be on the line quickly, because I thought we'd start off with this. There's an article she's just written called, what is it called? I'm trying to see what the name of the thing is. It's about the rising number of resignations by former ministers and what it shows us. The governing ANC refrain of "I will serve wherever I'm deployed" seems to be ringing hollow. She says in the article, despite the deployment humility myth, the backbenchers of the national legislature are eschewed. That must raise questions, particularly as the Zondo Commission is establishing a special task team into how Parliament exercises the constitutional oversight responsibilities it's meant to have. So I thought we'd get Marianne on the line. Is she there?
Not yet.
Right. Okay, well, this is
she's boycotting.
This timing is excellent. Well, let's go into it. I mean, all these ministers who are resigning now, we see Batabile is the most high-profile one of them all. What does this mean? Marianne, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us this morning, and well done on the article. It seems to be getting a lot of attention. That we constantly hear, even when it comes to the presidency, people saying, well, you know, if called upon by the ANC, I will put myself forward. But actually, there's a huge amount of ambition, desperation, and hunger inside the ANC's ranks for the positions that matter, right?
Absolutely, yes, certainly for some people, the ANC and public office that does become available by being on the ANC election list, whether that's for national, provincial, or even local government, certainly is a consideration. And it is, I think Stephen Friedman has written about it for a while, it is a leg up into the middle class, as he says. I think the important consideration is that conundrum, that contradiction that has now quite clearly arisen, where people do within the ANC say, I will serve wherever I'm sent. But at the end of the day, maybe that's not quite the case. And look, we can't discount at this stage. We're still waiting to hear. For example, somebody like Derek Harnicom. I've heard some rumors also with regards to Noma India and Fiketo. They may very well be sent out to as ambassadors, or there might be another position for them. So it's a little bit tricky at the moment, but certainly that whole law, and I'm calling it law intentionally, that the branches will send the ANC deployees, mm-hmm. has been shown as ringing quite hollow with us. And I think that's an important important takeaway for the ANC with regards to its organizational renewal that's been much talked about. But I think it's also a takeaway for us to just not quite always accept what's being said in the heat of the political noise, and just to interrogate a little bit.
Well, I'm curious about what you say in there about factionalism too, because a lot of what happens in cabinet is about making sure that all the parts of the ANC that need representation there, because otherwise Cyril looks like he's choosing one over the other, which he is, that there's this funny game of charades happening where they kind of pretend that they're appointing a minister to run a department when actually that minister is just there to represent a faction. The department doesn't even matter. It could be housing, it could be international affairs, it could be health. Ultimately, the people who are expecting those departments to deliver are going to suffer, but that minister is happy if their faction's represented.
I'm not going to put it quite that way. I think the department does matter. I think the minister in charge matters a lot. We've had some really good ministers who have managed to achieve, sometimes against the odds and despite everything. I mean, if you look at Tulas Ngwaezi at Public Works still isn't great, but it is a heck of a lot better off today than it was, say, 5 years ago. So I'd be a little bit more circumspect around that. But your point with regards to faction and factional appointments is absolutely spot on. It's part and parcel of it is, of course, politics, and the particular kind of politics that we're doing here in South Africa. Others is obviously the blunt reality that while the Constitution gives the president the prerogative to appoint whoever he or she would like in cabinet, the reality is that a president can't continue unless he or she has the support of the political party. And we've seen that with Thabo Mbeki in 2008 and when he was recalled. Yeah. So it's an incredibly, incredibly difficult balancing game. And you're right. Certainly, President Cyril Ramaphosa does depend quite a bit on COSATU and the SACP for support within the tripartite alliance. We've seen both the SACP and COSATU coming out very strongly in support of him during the run-up to the elections. Ms. Losi, who's COSATU president, was on Cyril Ramaphosa's CR17 slate at NASREC. Mm-hmm. So you do see a lot of ministers with trade union backgrounds, with SACP backgrounds in the cabinet. And also you will see some of the ministers and deputy ministers in the executive that are more, let's call it more closely associated with the radical economic transformation grouping. They're also represented. So it's an incredible juggling act.
You know, I'm glad we have your article to start this discussion this morning, but there's lots of other stuff to get into. If you want to read Marianne Merton's article, you can find it in the Daily Maverick. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Marianne. Always good to check in with her. There is so much to start with, ladies and gentlemen. Shall we begin with the very issue she raises here? Cyril Ramaphosa, Kai, you wrote something just this week about how Ramaphosa is dead. Finished, right?
No, it never existed.
Go on, tell us more.
I think probably from way back in NASREC in December 2017, a couple of us said there's no such thing as a Ramaphosa moment. The reality is that in NASREC, an ANC president was elected. And if the collective frustrations of the country were on how the ANC was governing or not governing, then for me that remained the same. It didn't matter who the figurehead of the ANC was. Obviously, a lot of people simply had the sense of relief that it wasn't Jacob Zuma. But for me, that sense of relief did not translate into some form of euphoria. I just didn't see what it changed for the fate of the nation. A lot of change for the ANC, but the ANC and the nation are not the same thing.
But the ANC, which Marianne just referenced in her article, and which you've referenced in another article that you wrote, is all about cadre deployment. And what we see when we see a cabinet shuffle, or a change in the cabinet from a president who's now supposedly got a mandate, is just cadre deployment. It's moving people around. It's arranging the chess pieces on the board. this is a serious problem in South Africa and will continue to have service delivery effects.
Yeah,
right?
It is. So, in fact, my article in the Business Day today is exactly about that. There is the issue of patronage versus what is the alternative to patronage. And the key issue here is that, firstly, I think as Marianne was alluding to earlier, remember the story that we get sold by NC politicians is that they're all victims of this intractable thing called the branches. If the branches say go and jump over Kilimanjaro, they are obliged to do so. If the branches go and say go and sit there, then that's what they say. I sever the pledge of the branches. Malusi Kikaba said it when his name was on the MP list, and people are like, well, but remember how you left in the first place. Like, well, the branches have demanded it, so therefore I must do it. So, of course, the key problem with that type of nonsense is that eventually fate and reality will intervene, because now suddenly all these guys that are resigning or retiring, they are no longer saying that, well, actually, it looks like the branches were wrong. Because my question should be, wait, weren't you coerced into doing this by this thing called the branches? Have they now said to you that actually retirement is much better for you? On what basis do they do this? So we've always known that statement indeed was rubbish, and you're seeing it now when these people are now resigning. So these types of issues, unfortunately, translate into the paralysis at the state level, because what we're seeing here is that when the ANC sort of decides that whatever matters to it must then automatically translate to what matters for the country, you see that there is no perfect correlation here. Running a country and versus being a member of a political party are two completely different things, and we need to get to a state where the government actually acknowledges this. So what I actually did some research, and there was an article that was actually written in Barcelona by somebody who said that, well, actually what happens is that the way to break the patronage network is that if political parties become more contested, then they actually start gravitating away from the patronage and saying, well, actually, how do we then ensure that the bureaucracy is much stronger than what it used to be? Because then suddenly they focus on state institutions rather than elevating their own members into positions of power.
What do you think of that, Kenton?
Well,
for me,
the thing that came to mind when you were talking about rearranging the chess pieces, I thought it's more like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Really, the entire issue right now is I really don't care whether Butterbili Dlamini is there or not, because frankly nothing's going to change. You still have a communist running trade and industry. You still have communist running economic development. So how do we fix this?
And therefore no economic growth projected
exactly
anywhere into the near future. Pumi, when you hear stories about these ministers who have resigned, are you as cynical as Canton? It makes no difference?
Well, I mean, I'm a lot like Kaya. Remember when I said to you, the thing about the ANC membership is it's only, what, 1.2 million South Africans, maybe? And that's not the same as the rest of us, the 50 million people that make up this country. So for me, that thing that's really the problem is, how do we get to a place where the will of the people is actually what is, you know? So when we think about those policies, most fascinating thing for me watching NASREC, because that was the first time that we were actually let behind the curtain.
Right.
To see
we got
who,
to be in the room.
Is look at all those people. Who the hell are all those people that are voting? And they don't even get a one person, one vote. It's not like a democracy there, you know. Certain people get two votes, certain parts of them. Mm. And this is the power that's kind of been, I think, projected onto Batabile, the fact that she is the president of the Women's League. I don't think that Batabile is going to create it. I think it's going to be a whimper. We're all going to be sitting here going, what a damn squib. We thought Batabile had so much power.
She'll
she had this beast that she was wielding within the ANC.
She'll disappear into the ether.
And it won't be a thing. You know, so all of this moving around of people walking away and resigning and all
but,
of that
but
stuff.
But Batabile is in trouble this week. And Kaya, you referred to this in your writing as well this week. Batabile is in trouble because she's so amateurish are some of these people that they don't even realize when they're implicating themselves in criminal activity. She said in her resignation letter, by
10
her,
pages, huh?
signed by her own hand,
that she's party to criminality.
Yeah, that there are ANC wives who are benefiting from contracts and tenders. So obviously someone picks up on this and goes, hey, we're going to lay criminal charges.
It was the
DA, right?
Yeah, of course it was going to be the DA. And the reality here is that she has a duty as a public office bearer to actually make these things available to law enforcement agencies. So, of course, the thing here is that she was clearly very aggrieved by the fact that she was left out of cabinet. A lot of people were surprised because there's always been this theory, as my colleague said, that, you know, the Women's League position commands such great respect and such great clout within the ANC. And it now turned out that Ramaphosa simply said, well, actually, I'm just not going to appoint you. And clearly, there's not going to be a fallout. Remember, the key thing here is that the people within the ANC...
Well, there's one thing we know about the ANC Women's League. They do what they're told. Do you remember them? They do, and they listen to men. And when they have to support men like Jacob Zuma or other men, deputy ministers of education who are caught in Cubana fist fights with women, it seems to me that they don't stand up for women at all. They do exactly what they're told.
But you must know, you know, context is so important. If we think about it, Kaya, and I'll give it back to you. The thing about the Women's League for me has always been, think about the genesis of this thing. Right? Where did it start? And all it really was a, you know, like a first wives club, a support group for the women whose husbands were incarcerated or being persecuted by the state. It in itself, and there were people in there who were in their own right activists of all sorts. But by and large, what that thing was, is it was a support group. It was, we're going to look after you. Your husband has been, you know, all of those women who were kind of thrust into this world simply because their husbands were to, and that has always been in the DNA of the Women's League. And because that is where it started, and that's why it is the way that it is. It remains that even though there are political ambitions within the Women's League, what the Women's League is within the ANC structure and what it is in its DNA is a support group for, you know, the First Wives Club.
Yeah. It's like Activists Anonymous.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's what it is. And it's never really broken itself and created a sense of autonomy, which was to say, look, we are here because we champion women's rights, but we just happen to have a political affiliation with the ANC. They start off by saying that we are here to represent the ANC, but because we appear to be female, we're going to the ANC, we're a women's structure. There is nothing about the ANC Women's League that appeals to women out there who don't have any political allegiances to say, I feel represented by that structure. And not only do I feel represented, this is a structure that is actually sitting at the table of political negotiations, elevating the cause of women in the country. And that's always been their biggest weakness.
Which is kind of like exactly like the Youth League doesn't represent youth either.
There is no Youth League in the ANC, remember?
Of course.
I don't know why you say such things, but it's blasphemous.
But they have paid lip service to the Youth League by putting Ronald Lamola and, you know, people like... These are supposedly the young people in the ANC. I mean, they're all older than everyone in this room, but they are the younger because all the young people left with Julius.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, probably Ronald Lamola is the one person who, on competence, would probably have made that cabinet in the way. I think he really has distinguished himself. And remember, where he found the time to distinguish himself and become a scholar is because he had been kicked out of the party well during that suspension around the days of Julius Malema. So that turns out to be a good thing for him. And yes, of course, their definition of young people is not whether a person is young. It's whether a person is younger than who else the ANC has put out there. So that definition itself is problematic.
And this is not unique to our country. In America at the moment, we have three people who are contesting the US presidential election for next year who are all in their 70s. Some of them towards the 80 side of 70 and some of them towards the 70 side. But they're all old men.
Yeah, I mean, whenever I see Bernie Sanders, I always wonder if he's going to be alive by the end of whatever he's presenting. Because you feel like, look, old man, we like your thinking, but hey, dude, you're trying to get people to sign up for you to run the country for the next 8 years. You look like you're struggling to get off the stage. So it is a particular problem. And I think probably you want more younger people to then take more central roles and more primary roles in politics rather than them saying, yo, this thing is for old people. And unfortunately, when you look at parliament in South Africa, it looks like it's the most active old age home only because the EFF adds some color into it. That's really what distinguishes our parliament from any other old age home. So we do need to sort of start diversifying our politics. I'm not saying that all people are bad, but, you know, given
most
what we've seen, yeah, you know, the sense of energy and the ability to engage with the prevailing issues and to shape the agenda for the future, it just becomes a bit problematic when you hear somebody interviewing the deputy president about the fourth industrial revolution and you feel like, dear God, I don't think he actually even knows what the first one was. And then you hear the same deputy president saying, guys, be grateful if there's load shedding. It's a sign of economic growth. So when I heard last week that the economy is contracted by 3.2%, I actually wondered, I wonder what the deputy president interprets this to mean. We have a problem.
And you know, you talk about the economy contracting, and because this is your foundation being the economics of the system. Yesterday the numbers came out and the spending, you know, so the spending has gone up. The economy is contracted, but the spending has gone up by 2.4%, I think the number came out yesterday. And I was looking at that thinking, this is my favorite word from a couple of years ago, omni-shambles, actually. This country where, like, there's so many clusterfucks happening in so many different ways.
You guys use such words, yeah?
Yeah, we can.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Welcome to our
Thanks
party.
For letting me know. The SAP should never allow me to say
finally,
that.
Finally, Kaya can be himself.
Oh, welcome to the party.
But yeah. I think Pumi's referring to something I do want to tap into your brain for, because you've been paying more attention to the economy than most of these people who call themselves analysts. And if you look at that number of 3.2% contraction, and it's clearly, I mean, you hear Eskom saying that the amount of electricity that people need is decreasing every day. We are an economy that is in a backsliding position. There isn't much for Cyril to bank on here.
Yeah.
We hear about people being laid off everywhere, unemployment's on the rise. These are all very, very depressing statistics.
And yet we're spending on credits.
And government is spending more than it should. I mean, you would imagine that the one thing you could probably do is cut back.
Yeah.
We look at SAA, for example, which is in dire straits. What would you do with that, Kaya? I mean, where would we begin?
Yeah. So the big problem, of course, with the South African economy is that, you know, unfortunately, you get the impression that the governing party of the day has never really understood what the right economic plan for the prevailing conditions are. What they've done is that they've latched onto particular theories, and in some instances, they've got it right. But then again, they suffer from inconsistency. So you'd have one particular president who says, I'm going to champion this particular idea, this particular agenda. And if you stick to it, you tend to see the results. And I think the 3TM connection, which was Mbeki, Manuel, and Mboweni, they stuck to their guns in spite of the opposition. What you then so is that later on you found an ANC that was in, you know, what's the term, anyway the wind blows. So of course, if the communists in the party say you mustn't do this, and the unions in the party say you mustn't do this, they found a good ally in Jacob Zuma, who had no moral center or economic center, if I should just put it like that. So for him, his swaying led to a sense of paralysis where people actually didn't know what was the standing trajectory of the country. And of course, the whole point about being a president is that you have to make those type of difficult decisions that say, look, it might piss off a few people in the short run, but the long run impact is going to be this. And I think that's what we've missed in the country in the past. The issues that you have with SAA and even Eskom right now, what makes those issues unique is that, I mean, I've sat with Vianney Jahana before they fired him. Well, they say he resigned, but we all know what really happened. I've said to them, we went through the entire strategy.
But you predicted that, in fact.
Yeah, I mean, it was inevitable. It was inevitable. And the key issue here is that for as long as you've got this wonderful idea where people will get elevated into political office on the basis that enough branches said that we think you should go there, those people then start thinking that the economic and finance gurus who should actually intervene in the running of very complex businesses, I mean, these are the type of business that even people who are actually well-versed in business will struggle to run. So to then elevate somebody like Des van Rooyen and say you're going to be in charge of the department that gets to dictate to an entity of this nature what it ought to do and how it ought to run itself, I mean, that policy, it's absolute rubbish. And of course, we are seeing the consequence of it now. So I do think that the key issue here is that the economy itself, when we hear about the statistics, the one person who's more shocked to hear about them than we do is the president of the country and his party, because they are not a party that sits down and says, look, we've put this plan in place, we expect the outcomes to be as follows. So that when states says no, actually this is the actual outcome, then they say, oh, this is the part that must have gone wrong. So they sit there, they're like, what do you mean it's minus 3.2%? So they can't even respond proactively because they haven't put anything in place. They can't explain where the minus 3.2% comes from. They don't know what the number is going to be next week or the month after, simply because there isn't that sort of economic ideology that prevails within the ANC that is static and that is consistent. So in the absence of that, we're really just going to have to pray that states say finds us the right numbers.
Everything's a big surprise.
That's the big issue. And I do think that as a country, we probably need to find a way to break the stranglehold that incompetent politicians have on the parts of the economy that matter to us the most. I'm not going to say that politicians should not control what happens in parliament, but there must be things in the country that we decide that this is just far too important for us to live to its own devices. So the types of things that you see happening across the world, particularly in the question of the Reserve Bank, is that institutions that have a form of architecture that insulate them from ongoing political interference tend to thrive better. The reason that people hate the Reserve Bank so much in this country today is because in the Constitution there are mechanisms that have been put in to insulate it from excessive interference. You see the same thing with Chapter 9 institutions, where even the term limits are simply governed by the Constitution. So it doesn't matter what the minister of the day feels about you, you simply stay in your position.
Oh, God.
So those institutions tend to thrive. But everywhere else there is this this chaos, because you know one of the worst things that happens when Cyril Ramaphosa announced his cabinet is that, of course, it was reduced. But the problem is that him reducing his cabinet, it means that people are moving around. People move with their own directors general because for some bizarre reason, people seem to marry their ministers in this country.
And special
spokespersons
advisors.
And DGs tend to marry their ministers.
And spin doctors.
They move around.
Special advisors. Yeah. My God, it's my worst thing. Is you have special advisors. People.
It's terrible.
You know, and I have nothing against Walter Mugwena, right? I have nothing against Walter
Mugwena. But you imagine
he's a nice person.
He's a nice person, right? But really, a special advisor to the Minister of Sports, based on what? Like
and
special
qualification? They're getting paid. They're getting paid better than
a lot of money.
Public or private money would pay them normally, because a special
pretty
advisor,
much the case.
Special salary.
But the fundamental issue that we haven't come to terms with yet, and this is the question that we need to keep constantly asking ourselves: how do we get the ANC to actually recognize the very basic thing that government does not create jobs? So that's the first idea. Government does not create jobs. It's the private sector.
Can I just help you there?
Just hang on one second. And then, the second thing that they need to get their head around, again, which they won't be prepared to accept, is that people on the ground are better off spending their own money than government is spending it on their behalf. So those are just two core ideas. Mm. And they need to get their heads around that. Now, the thing is, your three M's,
Mboweni, Emmanuel, and Mbeki,
they understood that, because that's exactly what they did. Mbeki basically set the economy loose. Manuel kept giving more money back to people in the form of tax cuts, because there were progressive tax cuts during the time that that he was in office, and we had economic growth that went with that. But the current crop doesn't understand those two things, and I doubt we're going to get to the stage where we can get ourselves to understand those two things.
So I just wanted to say that it's difficult to say that to a party that's just employed somebody called the Minister of Employment. There is no such thing as a Minister of Employment. There is no such thing as a Minister of Employment. What ought to happen is that there ought to be a minister in government that then says, what is the ideal ecosystem that would allow and enable business to thrive? Let us create that. The government is not supposed to be an employer. But of course, in this country, it's the easiest thing to do, to simply create a Minister of Employment. What shocked me the most,
well,
of course, is that
service, right?
It was a capitalist who came up with this. I'm like, dear God, what type of capitalist?
Who?
Cyril Ramaphosa. He's the one that said there's now a Minister of Employment.
Why do you think he's a capitalist?
I don't think he is.
How did he become a billionaire, Andy?
No, but because he was well-placed and outside of the political insiders. Remember, he was thrown out.
I'm trying to force you to say that. I'm not going to say it myself.
Effectively, I mean, let's remember, Pumi talks about the genesis of the ANC Women's League. Mm. Let's talk about what happened to Cyril Ramaphosa's political career, right? He was in there. He was tight with everybody that mattered for the early 90s. Early 90s. He was a big player. Thabo outmaneuvered him. Thabo saw this is his turn now to be the president.
The moment to strike.
Pushed Cyril right out. Cyril cowered away like a dog because he realized he could go into business and make a lot of money. He's the first proper BEE billionaire, right?
Yeah.
And he became exactly that. And he made his money because he was the most well-placed person.
Proximity to power.
And all the white capitalists, the white monopoly capital guys, all said, this is our dude.
Yep.
And they all backed Cyril, and he's made all of that money just from being the right guy at the right place at the right time. He's not a particularly good capitalist. He's not even that great a businessman, for all we know.
Someone once accused him of being an entrepreneur, and I threw my toys out on Twitter. I was like, please, show me one business that this man has ever started. And the answer is absolute zero.
None. So then, when everything has died down and the real power players have all become weakened by internal corruption and by Jacob Zuma's brilliant,
which was inevitable,
brilliant outmaneuvering of Thabo Mbeki, then Cyril sees his chance. He comes in as deputy president and he quietly bides his time while a lot of very bad decisions are made.
I don't think Cyril saw his chance. I think what Cyril was given, like a lot of his business opportunities, is he was given advice that says now is the time to move into this particular.
Well, what you're
space.
Saying is then even worse, because it means he's not even applying his own mind to
but
this.
But guys, this is what I've been saying about Cyril from the jump, right? Is a lot of Cyril's decisions, or what looks like decisions from the outside, are really a convergence of various pieces of advice. This is and also opportunity. Various pieces of advice that place him in places where what the benefit that accrues to those individuals who give that advice is questionable at best, right? And it's a convergence of it. So he's like, you know, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, wizard's chess in Harry Potter, all those chess pieces that you kind on Harry Potter that move on their own, mm-hmm. that you kind of, the player has to tell them where to move to. But the most fascinating part of it is how when they get bested by the next piece, they get cut down. They properly get like...
Killed. Yeah.
That's what we're seeing. It's a lot like Wizard's Chess. What we're seeing is pieces are being moved around this board, and we're not sure who is moving the piece into what position. But when they get cut down, my God, is it spectacular to watch. You know, it's like a mega crumbling.
Let's talk about one guy in particular, and then I want to move away from the macro cabinet stuff and into some other things that I think are quite interesting. Jeff Radebe has been there from...
25 years.
Yeah, 1994, right? Yep. This guy... And he resigns and he goes off into the wilderness. Now, he's got a very wealthy wife.
He didn't resign.
Well, yeah, okay.
Resignation is a consequence of getting fired from cabinet.
There we go. But Jeff goes off. He's also Cyril's brother-in-law. He goes
and Patrice's brother-in-law.
Correct. He goes off now and he's going to enjoy his life. But,
we hope so.
But there are people writing, and I saw one op-ed about, you know, congratulations to the minister for his contribution to society. Like, if you had to draw up a CV for Jeff Radebe, what good things could you put on that CV? Like, where did he excel? Where did he do so well?
When he was at transport.
Now, I can tell where he excelled. He excelled when he and Jacob Zuma came up with a theory that you can extend the term of office of the Chief Justice, Sandile Ngcobo, which was completely illegal, only for the fellow Justice of the Constitutional Court to have to write a judgment explaining to their own boss that the law didn't work out like that. For me, that was the highlight of Jeff Radebe's contribution to the country. He was the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development, who clearly didn't understand the law. Wait, remember Mendes Melane?
Yes.
Jeff Radebe. Remember Mqolisi Ncasana?
Yes.
Jeff Radebe was there. So those are the highlights.
So we've got a trail of incompetence and not a particularly illustrious career. So, I mean, like, this guy leaves after that many years where you could have made a positive difference.
Yes, but everyone remembers the C.L.I.T.
Wow, brother. It's a Thursday morning. Isn't this a family show? What is wrong with you people?
We here are totally uncensored.
I remember this stuff.
All right. So we've got rid of Batabile, Jeff, Noma India, Susan Shabangu, Togozile Kasa, Dipuo Duba, Siyabonga Kwele, and Derek Harnikom. And none of them are missed. Okay, let's go to some other things, because I had a much more...
I missed Kwele.
Do you miss Siyabonga Kwele?
Do you know why?
Well, his because, wife with because a drug.
This day, exactly 11 years ago, that's when Cheryl's life started crumbling. It was on the 13th of June, 2008, where the drug mule was actually caught in Brazil. And that's when her life started falling apart. So I missed Kwele because he was the Minister of Intelligence who had no idea what was going on in his own home.
Well, they didn't even know that they were going to get fired. I mean, really.
I tweeted that. Did you see my tweet? Because I said yesterday, well, these former ministers of intelligence deserve to be fired. If they couldn't even tell that they're not going to get redeployed, you can't fault Cyril for firing those people, because it's like, you couldn't even pick that up. You can't really be governing the country now. So that's how he got rid of those.
At this point, I'd like to have a vote as to Kaya staying here for a couple more weeks if he can, you know. All right, so.
Just to get him used to the language.
In all seriousness, we spoke about the Women's League. Which ANC outfit do you feel looks best? Because we see the Women's League outfit. There are those ANC leather jackets in green and yellow and black. There is Ace's lovely tie. There are a couple of the spokespeople. One of the flashy dresses is the he's now a minister. He was a spokesperson. He's also had terrible charges of assault and sexual abuse leveled against him, which have gone away because they settled out of court, apparently. You know who I'm talking about, Zizi Kodwa.
Oh, he's a deputy minister.
Deputy minister. Yeah. But he's in cabinet, so he's done okay.
No, he's not in cabinet.
No, the deputies are not in cabinet.
Can I just clarify? Deputy ministers are a way for the ANC to say, don't you want to have a 2 million rand salary? There you go. They are not a thing. They are not a requirement. Cabinet is made up of ministers. That's why they can't even stand in for ministers, because they're not members of cabinet.
I told you this last week.
I wasn't listening. I'm sorry.
They're not a thing. They're just a creation.
I stand corrected.
They're not. Like, I'm embarrassed. They don't have to be MPs to begin with. They don't have to have that as a part of getting the job. And they can't even stand in for their own minister.
And there are sometimes two. In
Yeah. So Jacob Zuma had this wonderful thing of just working out the numbers. So how many guys do we need? Who needs what? And how to ask the salary? He's like, oh, add a deputy minister there. Add this and this there. So again, it's one of those things that we probably should reflect back on as a country and say, what exactly is the role of deputy ministers? Because for me, the key issue is that if you talk about a particular ministry, the most important position in any ministry is the position of the executive, which is the director general. That is the person who must drive and implement the policy that has been chosen in the day. The role of deputy ministers is very elusive to crystallize because no one can actually understand what is the scope of activities that is allocated to that particular individual and why
they
can
need
that
to
not
pitch
be
up
done.
And do ribbon
I'm
yeah, they do the ribbons.
Ribbon cutting. I'm yeah. a KPI. Yeah.
And that's the problem. And these are the things that, that sometimes I get very frustrated by the South African voters because for me, we don't even interrogate the cost of what it is that we're voting for because we should be able to go back to Sri Lanka and say, actually, if you're going to appoint 30 or 35 deputy ministers, we'd like to know exactly what it is that they do and why these things cannot be done by the people that we're already paying, which are the bureaucrats within the system. Mm-hmm. So if you can start there and say there must be a justification for these things, otherwise they shouldn't be there. But I think what we tend to do is that we assume a lot of things are cast in stone. But the Constitution is a living document. I mean, the EFF is as with 6% actually advocated for the Constitution to be changed, and they're going to get there. So if we as a country of 55 million people, we can essentially find a way to lobby for the same thing, to say, actually, as a country, because we don't have an economy that's working, we can't afford these people. So it's fine. They can just take a backseat until we find a way to say the economy is growing at 3.2%. Then we'll have the deputy ministers. But right now, we simply just take things as they are, and he can load as many of them as he can.
What do you say to that? Fire all the deputy ministers?
Yeah, I said that last week, remember? Yeah.
No, see, I wasn't listening.
Gareth, right now I'm looking at you. I'm side-eyeing you right now Gareth, on somewhere out here spending, throwing our pearls before a swine. No. Why are you not listening to us?
You do very well in government.
This is my point. All right, so don't you want the tender, basically, for all this ANC paraphernalia they're making? There's jackets, there are scarves, there are all kinds of things. Gloves, I've seen ties. It sounds like a good business to be
in. Lela Duku. That Duku.
The Duke.
Yo.
Batabile was wearing one on that interview we played this morning.
Guys, we've spent 40 minutes on the ANC. Right. We really should move on.
Right. Can we talk about, because this is really, really funny. I watched for the first time in ages what's going on in the Conservative Party in Britain since Theresa May did. And you cannot believe the paltry quality of the guys and girls standing to take her place. They obviously inherit this poisoned chalice of Brexit, but man, are these underachievers. The Conservative Party, and I mean Jeremy Corbyn is not a difficult target to beat, but these guys are really making it a tough competition. They're trying to inject some excitement into this race, and they're all the most dreadful people. Have you seen any of them?
I have seen, I saw a
I think Boris
line
is gonna
of questioning.
Walk it.
I think he will, but I saw...
I think Boris right now is kind of hitting all of the spots in terms of what the UK public is currently pissed off about. They want this thing to be over and done with, one way or the other. And he's the only one who's finally saying, come hell or high water, by the time that Halloween rolls around, it is 31st.
It is appropriate, of course, that it's on Halloween Day.
Yeah, that that one way or the other, they will be out of the EU.
Yeah.
And I think that he's going to actually take it. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting was that the Labour guys tried to – you see, essentially, they can just actually force the situation by inaction because if they just simply refuse to finalize a deal – and then they don't convene Parliament so that Parliament can't do anything about it, then automatically a no-deal Brexit happens on the 31st of October. And I'm pretty sure that that's going to be the strategy on the part of the Conservatives because then they don't have to take responsibility for the outcome.
Yeah, and I think the worst thing, of course, is that the EU is not going to have an appetite to negotiate with Boris because he was one of the people that led them down to this mess in the first place. And when you look at really the leadership candidates out there, I mean, you know, Andrea Leadsom, she had to pull out of the contest against Theresa May because she accused Theresa May of not understanding what it takes to be a mother to a nation. Obviously, Theresa May has never had children, and everyone was like, what the hell did you just say? So that's how she got kicked out of the previous race. She wants to run again. Michael Gove, he was a good education secretary, except, of course, until he wrote the rules that say that people who have been caught possessing cocaine should never be allowed to be teachers ever again. And it turns out that he himself was snorting cocaine, so now that's a bit of a problem.
I love that. I love the fact that the media, though, the way that they're questioning those guys, you know, Batabile threatened us with small anyana skeletons for years, right? The media has held those guys to account. They're ruthless. They're talking to them about the snorting cocaine when he was like in varsity or high school or something. Yeah. Even all of that stuff.
But they
just
call out the hypocrisy wherever
they
find it.
Cut it open and it's laid bare for the people. They're just like.
And this is the thing that was missing, because I remember particularly heading up to Nazareth, everyone was like, we've got this Messiah coming. I'm like, no. You are talking about Jacob Zuma's deputy for the past 4 years. I kept reminding people, it was Jacob Zuma's deputy for the past 4 years. If you're saying you need a Messiah, you need a Messiah from what? You need a Messiah from the consequences of this party and what they've done for the past 9 years, but its deputy is the person that you're elevating. What rubbish is this?
Mm-hmm. But people like to imagine that there are superheroes and there are saints.
Villains.
We're desperate.
And there are villains.
We're desperate.
And they look to these people to solve all their problems. And mostly that's because they haven't been parented properly.
Oh, wow. I didn't know about that.
No, I'm telling you. Like, they're looking for a father figure, or they're looking for a mom, or they're looking for someone to solve all their problems. And this is also why people don't understand why so many people in America love Donald Trump, because they don't see him as a father or a friend. They just see him as someone who gets things done. They're not emotionally attached to him.
Yeah.
And this is the weirdest thing, and I see it in South African politics as much as anywhere else. Mm. Well, we're not less or more guilty.
Boris has been ticking exactly those boxes.
Yeah.
Because he pointed out that in the 2 terms that he was mayor of London, that crime actually dropped by 20%. And now under Sadiq Khan, crime has actually gone up hugely, particularly knife crimes. And he's a big fan in terms of stop and search of kids in particular, because they are the ones who are carrying the knives. And all of those things are actually ticking all of the appropriate boxes. So when people turn around at the press conference and say, but you refer to Muslim women wearing traditional dress as letterboxes, and he says, well, I'm always going to be speaking my mind freely. And
that
just kind
seems
of laughs
to
it
rub
off
a lot of people up the wrong way.
Yeah, it does. But ultimately, is that going to deter voters who are concerned about the fact that they're being priced out of the London market because oligarchs are buying up the properties? I think the answer is no.
But there is this funny thing that happens where people start to think of politicians in terms of the way that they think of their friends. They vote for someone they like, which is bizarre. And it's obviously something that you could look at in any country in the world. People find a leader who they think represents them. But what they're really doing is saying, would I go out? Do you remember when Al Gore and George W. Bush were up against each other and they asked a question on the news, one of the news networks? They said, who would you rather go out for a beer with?
Mm-hmm.
And it was the most bizarre question. I thought, neither of them is the answer. Because actually you want them to be doing hard work.
Yeah. The hard work tends to be invisible to most people. So most people actually don't even know what Cyril Ramaphosa does when he wakes up and he says he's going to work. So it becomes difficult for them to say, okay, this is a person whom I think has got the requisite skills to do this and that and that. I think these are the things that go on a daily basis. I think this is what drives the political agenda and this is what drives the economic agenda. So therefore that individual, based on what they're saying and based on how they conduct themselves, are the best place to do that. So what we do is that we actually then farm out the process. We then simply say, well, surely by the time they get onto the ballot, somebody has done that vetting for us, so therefore this must be the person to go with.
ACPZ man, there are lots of things happening in people's lives. I hear you, and I absolutely agree with you that we should be applying ourselves to all of those things.
Yeah.
But in reality, most people are just trying to get their kids to bloody school on time. You know what I'm saying?
But we're trying to now got a current crop of politicians who are keeping the messaging simple. So what did Trump say? Ban all Muslims. Build the wall. Make America great again. They're simple, short, to the point. And Boris is doing the same
lock
thing.
Lock her up.
Crooked Hillary.
And Boris is doing exactly the same thing. You know, he's saying, get crime down and, you know, let's take back the empire.
Yeah.
Even though that's a subtext of what he's speaking about. And I think that's the reason why he's actually going to end up taking this lot. So, yes, you know, would I want to have a drink with Boris? No, the guy is hugely bigoted, and, you know, I'd probably end up punching him at some point. But I do suspect that he's probably the best bet that the Tories have got right now. Because, frankly, if you look at Farage and what he's been doing of late.
You think Boris is a bad guy.
What I'm saying, look, no, actually, I think that Farage is flippin' smart. I think he's dangerous. I'm certainly not his target market, but I certainly think that he knows how to play his audience absolutely perfectly.
Well, that's why the Brexit Party is growing like
exactly,
it is.
Exactly. And people must be able to separate their dislike from a person
but then at least
from the fact that they're good at it.
That's exactly the point. And at least there's a place in Britain where these people can be housed, because the worst thing for any group, especially fanatics of any kind, is for them to be outside the tent pissing in. Right? You'd rather have them in the tent pissing out. And they need a home. And in South Africa, I sometimes wonder, because we have such a lickspittle, I love that word, and I think the one who came up with it was Thabo Mbeki long ago. DA, they really are just spineless. And I look at them and I think, if this is the opposition, then it's no wonder the ANC get away with everything they do and think they can get away with everything they do. There is very little credibility and gravitas in the DA.
But that is why the EFF and the FF Plus have been growing so much, because they've kind of reduced all of that and completely polarized everywhere in the world when you look at it, right? Is it's in what those short, sharp, tweetable sentences and positions are.
Sound bites.
Is what they do is they very quickly like dump down to the lowest common denominator, our biggest fears, and play that up. And that's why those areas grow. You know, is you play up those everybody's fears.
But you look
and they find the place.
Okay, Pums, but you look at the unions, right? They are by far punching well above their weight. The unions have such clout. It's unbelievable in this country. And they don't represent a majority of people or even a majority of employed people. What they might do is represent a majority of people who are employed by government. So it's interesting that they're in alliance with the very employers
but
that they say that they're going to fight against if the people who are members of those unions need to. It's crazy,
but
right?
Yeah. But the thing about it is...
No one sees that as ironic.
We here in this country are kind of... behind a curve in a lot of instances because of the way that our politics has kind of evolved. You know, it's we're like swimming like a crippled child, right? Mm-hmm. Our politics has evolved in a particular way, and that's created this... And Canton, being the capitalist in the room, would say, you know, he wants to break the back of the unions because what that has created, and this is why when you look at what happened in England with Margaret Thatcher, that's why she was able to create an environment that she did. But that's what you have to do, is you have to break the dependence of all of these parties to each other. That interdependence is what keeps us all kind of paralyzed in the state that we are in. If the SACP wants to run a particular course, then they must do it, and they must do it on their own. They mustn't be in some kind of tri-party like alliance. If the unions want to create, they cannot then be supporting the ruling party
Irvin Jim runs in this last election.
No, he walked. Running requires a form of energy. He just walked into the ballot and was hoping that people would remember who he was. Again, he ran a very lackluster campaign, and my thinking has always been that it would make more sense for all these alliance partners to actually put their own names on the ballot, because what that does is that it allows you to then vote on or disagree with the ANC based on the prevailing issues of the day. But to then say that we're actually going to put our names together into one ballot box, it means that you are stuck with the decision that the ANC makes.
Well, SACP tried that at municipal elections last time around.
Oh, that was because they had this thing against that guy called Jacob, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I think they're probably not going to repeat that. But
and
I think
they learned spectacularly why that's a bad idea.
Contesting.
That's the thing about contesting, and it sounds like I'm a stuck record, but that's the thing that says, and I'm not advocating for anarchy, but people have got to stand up. People have got to stand up and organize into structures of what they believe in, and then they have to be vocal and lobby and fight for it. But you can't do it within this particular tepid pool that the ANC has created for all of these people. Yeah. If you are in
it's
that
like
tepid
a safe
pool,
space.
Yeah, you know, it's like,
look,
it's
the only
all warm.
The only time this stuff is going to happen is if you have a single issue that's going to get a critical mass of people actually riled up enough to get together. So we had that with Jacob Zuma. So that was the first time people were able to actually rally around a single point. I don't think we have that single point anymore that's going to bring us together as South Africans.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, unlike the Hong Kong scenario, for example, where now you have massive turnouts. I mean, these turnouts that we are seeing right now are we haven't seen since the time of the Hong Kong handover. And
it's students, it's young people, it's people who are employed.
Well, no, it cuts across the board. And it's a single issue that they're basically rallying around. And the issue that they're rallying around is that they're terrified of the consequences of Beijing being able to meddle with the justice system that they've got out there.
Yeah.
And which is kind of interesting, again, because...
Well, you famously don't like marches. And you've told me before you think marches don't achieve very much.
Yeah, well,
but
exactly.
But you seem to have a different opinion here.
No, that's a nice way to jog. No. No, not at all. Because if you look in terms of the particular context right now, I assume you guys are aware that there's these major clashes that are going on in Hong Kong right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the streets are literally, the city has come to a standstill over the past several days. And the issue really is that the Hong Kong government was wanting to pass legislation that would allow them to have the ability to send certain people outside of the country to face charges, even in scenarios where there's no formal extradition treaty.
Okay.
Now, what basically triggered this was that there was a Hong Kong couple that went on holiday to Taiwan, and the boyfriend basically murdered the girlfriend and stuffed her body in a suitcase and left the body in a train station, got back to Hong Kong, where he basically admitted to his crime.
There's a podcast about this.
Yeah. Now, but basically the scenario was that Hong Kong cannot try him for the murder because the murder didn't apply, take place in Hong Kong. But they couldn't send him back to Taiwan to face trial because of the fact that they don't have any sort of extradition treaty with Taiwan.
Mm.
But at the same time, they do have extradition treaties with other countries in the world. It just so happens because of the separation of powers that was put in place by the agreement that they had at the time of the Hong Kong handover, they were very clear that they wanted to prevent a scenario where Beijing was able to turn around and say, hey, you have an anti-Beijing person out there, send him back here for trial.
Mm-hmm.
The question of actually real criminals being shipped back to either Taiwan or to the mainland is something where there needs to be a mechanism for it. And the law that they're trying to pass is not saying that, China has the blanket ability to do so. It does say that China has the ability to ask that certain people be sent across. And those people won't just be sent across. They'll be subject to a legal process where the courts ultimately have to decide whether this person should be sent back or not, which is a reasonable thing. However, the entire idea... Look, Beijing's control of Hong Kong is inevitable.
Sure.
And it's a question of when everything eventually gets sucked into the mothership. But the people of Hong Kong really are desperate to cling onto their independence.
Whatever independence they can.
Independence they can. And that is the backbone of this.
So these protesters are effectively saying, we just not yet, Beijing.
Exactly. Yes.
But
it goes back to my point that you need to have those single issues that can rally us together. And, the economy is not an issue that mm-hmm. all of us can go out and march for. We need something that is going to so piss us off that all of us take the streets in our numbers. And I don't know what that issue is going to be.
I thought the EFF had found it in the land and jobs question, but apparently the voters didn't agree, because I thought those are probably the two key issues. I think the jobs issue.
No, we've said before, voters don't give a shit about land. And, the surveys have shown consistently that, it's an issue for less than 2% of the populace. They do care about jobs. They do care about wealth.
Yeah.
But, you don't want a piece of rural land. You want a cushy job in the urban centers, and you want to be able to have that BMW, and you want to be able to have the townhouse in Daneford and all of that kind of stuff.
Which is exactly why everybody wants to be a minister or deputy minister, because mm-hmm. that's what you get, a cushy job, BMW, two houses in Joburg and in Cape Town.
I just remembered, the tragedy of people resigning as MPs is that Kebby Mapatso is now next on the list.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Actually,
Kebby, he also
had a sex tape.
Remember, he also had a sex tape.
It wasn't a tape. It was a still. It was a still, right?
No, there was,
because I didn't see any movement.
It was a still, and it was, you know, it was quite harrowing for some of us, because you know, like, there's a lot of people who are really worried about the state of their marriages. So, and the less attractive you think your husband is to other people, right?
You the would more comfortable think, you are.
The more kind of, you know, you kind of have a less competition. You have less.
Is that how marriage works, Kanthan?
I'm not great to get into this conversation at all.
The one thing, I was looking at that picture and I was thinking, you would think that you're safe when your husband has a half an arm.
Wow. Oh my God!
And yet there he is. There he is in the hotel room cheating.
We need a new topic. We need to move on from this.
Let's talk about Gigaba.
No. It's now becoming a competition of whose sex tape was better. No. I cannot participate in this.
I did also see an article where Gigaba is asking, very nicely asking women to please stop asking him to show them.
Oh my God, that's terrible.
There was a song called Show Them.
Yeah.
Wasn't the song? Yeah.
Show Them.
Yes.
All right. Well, this has been fun. Thank you very much to all our participants this morning. The Burning Platform, brought to you by Nando's. It's like a super, super hot this morning.
I didn't know it meant that you burn bridges, but anyway. This is what it is.
Kais Tole, thank you very much, sir. Kanthan Pile, thank you very much. Pumi Mashiko, thanks so much for joining us. And C.S. Angweni and I will see you tomorrow morning at 6 a.m., bright and early. But you're all welcome to join whenever you like, because genuinely we're getting lots and lots of feedback from people here who are thrilled that the Burning Platform is as fiery as it was this morning. All right, very good. That's all we got time for. See you tomorrow.
This is CliffCentral.com.